Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ACTIS podcast, a bi-weekly program dedicated to bringing you closer to the difference makers in CDI and sharing the latest news relevant to the CDI profession and ACTIS. My name is Rebecca Hendren. I am the director of ACTIS, and I'm going to be your host for today's show, which will feature a discussion with Okemona Iwateri, BSN, MA, CCDS, CDIP, CCS, and Okemona is the Director of CDI at Montefiore Medical Center in the Bronx, New York. And Okemona has more than 14 years of CDI experience and more than 20 years of nursing experience. Currently, she oversees a diverse staff, including foreign medical graduates, registered nurses of various backgrounds, coders, and physician assistants. As part of her CDI experience, she's educated nurses and providers on CDI techniques, workflows, and all of that. She has worked on the practice briefs and white papers with both ACTIS and AHIMA, including serving as a co-author of Clinical Validation, the Next Level of CDI, and also working on the 2019 version of the ACTIS-AHIMA Guidelines for Achieving a Compliant Query Practice. And Okemona is a current member of the ACTIS Advisory Board, along with our other guest, Trey LaCharité, MD, FACP, SFHM, CCS, CCDS. Trey is Medical Director for CDI and Coding at the University of Tennessee Medical Center in Knoxville, Tennessee. And besides being a practicing hospitalist, Trey is also a Clinical Associate Professor of Internal Medicine and the Curriculum Director of the Internal Medicine Residency Program's Hospitalist Rotation. He also has extensive experience and responsibilities in case management, UR, compliance, denials management, and resident education. Along with his extensive bio, as I mentioned, he is a member of the ACTIS Advisory Board, and he's a regular presenter at the ACTIS Conference, as well as the ACTIS Physician Advisor Forum. So I'm sure many of you will be very familiar with both Okemona and Trey, and I am delighted to welcome them to today's program. Before we begin, a quick reminder that the ACTIS podcast offers 0.5 ACTIS CEUs for the first 4 days after posting, which you can use towards your CCDS or CCDSO recertification requirements. And of course, we'll share the instructions for how to get that CEU at the end of the show. So stay tuned for that. And now, before I start my conversation with Trey Okemona, here's a note from our sponsor.
CDI professionals need a day-to-day reference when conducting their medical record reviews, one that can provide trusted clinical indicators for compliant and effective physician queries and easy-to-use reference tables. The 2026 ACTIS Pocket Guide is your essential CDI resource. It includes updates to clinical diagnostic standards, official guidelines for coding and reporting, ICD-10 CM codes, and CDI critical thinking tips. The 2026 ACTIS Pocket Guide is co-written by industry veteran Lori Prescott, RN, MSN, CCDS, CCDSO, CDIP, CRC, and James Manns, MD, CCDSO, a practicing physician at Mayo Clinic steeped in the latest physician documentation terminology. The 2026 ACTIS Pocket Guide is a winning combination of practical, tailored CDI tips and resources, and clinical, regulatory, and coding guidance adapted from the official sources. The 2026 ACTIS Pocket Guide offers the latest information CDI professionals need to know, including fiscal year 2026 guidelines, AHA 2025 coding clinic guidance, SOFA 2 score criteria released in October 2025, new provider tips from Dr. Manns, updated critical thinking tips, treatment protocols, and diagnostic criteria, the latest updates related to social determinants of health, 75 plus conditions, now including neonatal respiratory distress syndrome, and more. Order your copy today by using the link in today's show notes. And now, back to the show.
And thank you so much, Okemona and Trey. Welcome to today's edition of the ACTIS podcast. Thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you very much.
So today we're going to talk about clinical validation denials, which is an ever popular topic, unfortunately, because it's something that we continue to see as a huge problem in the industry. So I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me today, because I think what we're going to discuss will be quite useful for a lot of people. So I'm going to start with the basics. So what is the importance of clinical validation and even creating a clinical validation workflow, whether that includes manual processes, your CDI software, your clinician feedback, et cetera? I'll kick it over to Trey to get us started on that.
Well, I think, as we all know, the problem with clinical validation is it has become the largest weapon in any payer's arsenal to deny reimbursement to a facility. It is by far the vast majority of our MS-DRG validation denials. I bet you the actual coding mistakes that auditors catch in my shop is less than 10%. It's all clinical validation, just absolutely insisting that their position and clinical criteria are better and more appropriate than ours. With that in mind, you've got to have a workflow process to defend against these things, and you've got to have a feedback process. And I think the feedback process may be even more important than an appeals process, because thus far over the years, the payers are just simply taking the position that they're right and we're wrong. So you've really got to head it off at the pass and make sure the providers are not documenting things that don't exist.
I mean, I completely agree with what you're saying, Trey, because we have this increasing rate of denials, right? And we keep talking about how every year it's increasing, but what are we doing to help kind of offset or prevent that from occurring? And clinical validation helps to provide a framework and guidance on how CDI programs, or just how, you know, clinical care centers who provide that kind of, like, who have a clinical documentation program should operate, right? So if you have CDIs, you know, clinically validating things that aren't really going to help you in terms of the process of, like, preventing denials, then you need to make sure everyone's on the same page, as well as making sure your physicians are all thinking the same way clinically as best as you can, because we're all independent thinkers. But you want to make sure everyone's on the same page in terms of what constitutes, like, you know, sepsis, what criteria we're using for sepsis that are at our institutions. And like, how are we as an organization going to operate? Like, what diagnoses are we going to target? Are you going to attack everything? Or are you going to focus on what your payers are trying to deny the most at your institution? So if you have a workflow in place and you start with, like, the diagnosis you want to target and what the organizational needs are, I think we should be in a better place than trying to, like, you know, target everything, which is going to cause a bit of chaos.
How do you believe clinical validation affects the denials that are received by acute care facilities?
Hopefully clinical validation can help reduce the number of denials that we're getting from insurance companies. And, you know, if we have the right process in place, we can make sure that as an organization, we're all in line with what we're trying to do. So if we have physicians using sepsis 2 and the CIs using sepsis 3, clearly we're going to have an issue, because you can't clinically validate someone when they're using a different criteria than you're using. But also, we can create sort of a united front when we're speaking to insurance carriers about how they are applying their criteria to us. If we can say that we're using sepsis 2 and they're using sepsis 3, we need to be able to have that discussion with them and, you know, hopefully get on the same page or reduce the number of denials that we're receiving.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Trey?
Well, I think at least from our standpoint, the main thing we try to do with clinical validation here is at least make sure we're not submitting things that are extraneous or outside of the things that we know the payers are going to deny regardless. For example, if you're a sepsis 2 shop, they're going to insist on sepsis 3. You're not going to win those. That's a contracting issue. If the payer's using rifle criteria and you're using KDIGO, as long as you think you're right, that's a contracting issue. You want to make sure that the other things that are clearly misdiagnosed are not being submitted so that you can reduce the number of denials. Some things, like I said, you're only going to be able to achieve any reduction through your contracting department, if at all possible.
What is your organization's strategy regarding denials? Do you target specific diagnoses, or do you validate everything you can?
So here we target specific diagnoses because those are the things that have, you know, easily recognizable criteria that are very concrete and numbers based, and there's no clinical judgment, if you will. For example, for acute renal failure, if your creatinine increases by such and such, well, then you've got it. If it doesn't, then that's not an issue. It's a lot harder to clinically validate things like acute encephalopathy because no two patients present the same in terms of the abnormal behavior they might exhibit. So we target specific things. If there is, you know, the occasional one-off, somebody is just completely off base and it's brought to our attention, we might address it, but we try to limit ourselves to things that we know we can impact.
So it's much the same here. We target specific diagnoses, you know, your typical sepsis, AKI, shock, respiratory failure. We also are teaching institution. So we have your interns doing very comprehensive documentation, as well as the residents, fellows, and the attendings. And sometimes, you know, if you want to validate the entire record, you may be in that record for 2 hours. And it doesn't seem to make sense to go back in time and validate something from like 10 years ago that has little to no effect on the patient's actual inpatient stay. So we target the things that specific diagnoses that actually will affect the patient's, you know, severity and so on and so forth. And we also have particular organizational initiatives, you know, quality related that we may occasionally target that may not directly affect the DRG, but, you know, we know that this is the organizational initiative, so we target that as well.
So here's something that I'm wondering, and that is, what do you do when a provider adamantly stands by their obviously clinically invalid diagnosis? For example, they say something still exists despite a clinical validation query. How do you handle that?
So I actually, you know, at the end of the day, they're the responsible party for documenting what's in the record. So I can't say, well, I don't agree with you, I'm not going to capture it, because, you know, we have to capture it. You insist upon it and we queried you, you still insist upon it, that's fine. But then afterwards, we will escalate it to our medical director, who is fantastic. He has a physician who works with her, and they will speak to that physician and say, hey, so we noticed you've been documenting such and such, but it doesn't meet our clinical criteria as an organization. So let's discuss this. And she'll do whatever one-on-one education she needs to do with that individual. But we do get physicians who say, no, this meets the criteria for, you know, an MI. And we're like, well, actually, it doesn't. But since you agree on it, you go ahead, because you're the one legally responsible for like adding the diagnosis to the record.
Right. Jay, what do you have to say about that as a provider as well?
Well, the bottom line here is, if it doesn't exist, we don't code it. Even if the clinician adamantly says this condition exists and you're pulling out the, you know, professional society guideline papers that says, actually, no, this does not exist, we won't code it. I understand that's not following the coding guidelines, but the problem is the OIG does not care about the coding guidelines. The Medicare manual says that that diseases have to be documented and supported. And if you can't support it, then the OIG considers that fraud. And an OIG determination with extrapolation will be tremendously more costly than, you know, a payer denial or two. So if it doesn't exist, we don't code it.
So ways to help this, a lot of organizations create maybe clinical definitions criteria or central clinical resource. Is that necessary for a program to have a successful clinical validation workflow?
I think that answer is absolutely. If you don't have house-wide definitions that every service line has agreed to, then you're always going to have sort of this undertone of conflict between different services as to what a particular patient might have. And so if you're going to do clinical validation, you need to make sure everybody's on the same page telling the exact same story. Otherwise, your efforts are going to kind of be wasted as one service line says, well, no, this is the definition we use. And the other service line says, no, this is, well, this is the definition we use, and so on and so forth. So I think it's absolutely fundamental to any clinical validation process.
Okay, Amanda, does your organization have system-wide definitions too?
We actually have definitions for our medical center that, you know, go back about maybe 10, 15 years, and we're working on an internal clinical criteria guidance, like a handbook, basically, of like what we're going to use as an organization. And we actually are, fingers crossed, pretty close to completing it. But it's I agree with Trey, like you need to have like definitions as an organization that everyone's operating the same way. And again, we're a teaching institution. So occasionally you get someone who's like, oh no, I think it should be this way. But the organization says it's, you know, this way. So you have to be in line with whatever the organization is thinking. And it helps because you really want to make sure that if you're querying, you're using the same, you know, criteria as your physicians. And it helps you in terms of like making sure that when you are having that discussion, let's say contracting discussion with a pair, this is the definition we're going to use. Or even like a vendor, if they're trying to use AI to help you find, you know, query opportunities or something like that, you want to make sure that you give them what criteria you're using to make sure it's valid by your, you know, your standards. So,
Absolutely. So then how do you know when your clinical validation strategy is actually successful?
It could be because that you have less denials, but I don't know if that's going to happen for anyone anytime soon. I would say it's that, but payers are changing in terms of like how they are going to find opportunities for like denying the diagnosis or like the DRG. So, I mean, it could be just seeing the little wins, like having this one case overturned and because like this is the criteria that you stuck with and this is what's going to work. Or it could be agreeing on this criteria for your contracting purposes. But I think success may vary depending on the organization and what their goals are.
Yeah, I think in my organization, my measure of success is how rarely do I get an email that says, Dr. So-and-so continues to document this, which clearly does not exist, whether that be from a coder or a medical director of one of our centers of excellence. I mean, maybe once a month I get those and I have to sit down and go, what are they thinking? So that doesn't happen very often. It used to happen a lot more, you know, 15, 18, 19 years ago, however long ago it was we started. But now it very rarely happens. We know we're still going to get the denials for whatever the payer insists on having so that they can issue a denial. But as far as, you know, identifying someone who's outside of our clinical definition parameters or guardrails, that doesn't happen very often.
Well, that's good. Do your organizations have what could be considered a feedback loop for CDIs and physician leadership regarding commonly validated and denied diagnoses? We often hear of some programs that don't really get the information on what is coming back as a denial. So what sort of setup do you have?
Well, we just started, started refining our feedback loop. So we are having combined CDI and HIM sessions where we discuss like denials. And this past month, we had one on respiratory failure. but also we're going to start discussing like the top 10 denials that we're receiving. And if it's related to a CDI query or like an HM query, we're trying to figure out what is the criteria that that individual used. Do we need to refine a criteria? Something like that. In addition to the fact that our medical director has been presenting to different clinical services what their denials are and discussing with them, like, okay, how did we go right or wrong in this particular instance or something like that. So we do have a feedback loop. We are refining it, especially because we are working on a clinical criteria handbook, essentially. But we do have a loop with the CDIs, HIM, and physician leaders.
We have some more indirect routes, if you will, via our trauma surgery PI process, where they review every mortality from the week before. There's monthly critical care medicine, M&M. We have a house-wide mortality review process where I look at every case that died within our walls that didn't have an SOI and ROM of 4M4. And if I find things like that, I put in my findings, and that gets sent to that Center of Excellence medical director and then on to that attending. The trauma and critical care medicine rounds are with their residents and fellows, so they're constantly getting that kind of feedback. And then, like I said, very rarely do I get that email, maybe once a month, that says so-and-so is way off base. And if it's a recurrent problem, then I'll go do a one-on-one.
Excellent. We are reaching the end of our questions now. Do you have any final thoughts to share on clinical validation denials before we wrap up this program?
I think we need some sort of cumulative effort, something at a state and congressional sort of level, if we're going to stop the payer onslaught. I find it absolutely incomprehensible that a non-clinician who was never at the bedside of a patient is able to tell my board-certified practicing physicians that know what they diagnosed doesn't exist. That's an absolute travesty. And I don't think individually we're having a whole lot of success. I think we need some sort of large, cumulative, comprehensive effort.
And the thing that's actually bothering me nowadays is that apparently a lot of them are using AI for this. So, like, how do we know that your AI bot is using the correct criteria? Like, you're just kind of doing this denial just to see if you can get it past us. And the amount of effort it takes on just an organizational level is just unbelievable. But then, you know, you have to think of all the organizations, not just mine and Trey's, but all the organizations that are doing this. So I agree with Trey, we definitely need something on a national level to kind of make sure that this isn't becoming more and more egregious, because that's what it feels like. It feels like this is becoming just out of control. And we need some sort of organized effort to say that this needs to stop, and or to create guidelines for this, better guidelines.
Absolutely. I think everybody listening would agree with you there. Well, thank you, Trey and Okemena, for giving up your time today to discuss this. And thank you for being on the podcast with me. And of course, now it's time for something completely different, the ACTIS update. I'm going to tell you everything that's going on inside your association. I hope everyone listening is firmly in the holiday spirit. I know I am. It is my absolute favorite time of year. I love the warm glow of lights, the holiday food, especially my British favorites, of course. And if you're interested in them, feel free to shoot me an email and I would love to tell you all about the special holiday food we eat in the UK and the Christmas carols. It all just warms my heart. I will be taking some time off over the holiday season. I hope that all of you are as well, to spend with your loved ones. The ACTIS office will, of course, be closed as well, so all the team can enjoy some well-deserved time off. We will be closed from December 24th until January 2nd. However, should you have an urgent inquiry in that time, you can always reach out to the HC Pro customer service team, who does keep a skeleton staff working for much of the holiday period. And for that, I am deeply grateful to their dedication. And if you do have questions specifically about the CCDS or CCDSO credentials, you can reach out to certifications@hcpro.com. And now, as we turn our attention to the new year, are you already thinking about your goals? I know I've been thinking about mine for some time now as we near the end of the year, and perhaps professional development opportunities are on your list. If so, I want to bring your attention that the deadlines are nearing for two speaking opportunities in 2026. Firstly, speaking at the Revenue Integrity Symposium, which we lovingly refer to as RIS. And if you have any tweens in your life, that moniker may now make you smile. It does for me. But RIS is a major professional milestone in the revenue integrity field. And speakers there gain enormous professional benefits from being recognized as experts, highlighting their knowledge and dedication, them and their teams. And of course, we have greatly enhanced networking abilities by attending these in-person events. So the 2026 event will be held September 24th through the 25th in the beautiful city of Savannah, Georgia. It's absolutely lovely. And you could be one of those professionals who step forward and become a key part of the event. And of course, any speakers do receive free registration for the conference. Along with topics covering the full breadth and variety of revenue integrity, RIS also does a deep dive into denial prevention across the revenue cycle. And so it's a wonderful opportunity for CDI specialists and revenue integrity professionals to come together to collaborate and jointly discuss what remains one of the most tricky problems that afflicts the healthcare profession. The online application can be found in our show notes, and please note that you are prompted to create an account when you submit an application, but it really is a very easy process, so don't let that stop you, and you can apply until January 12th. That may still feel a long time off, but you know, perhaps you are going to take time over the holidays to think about what you want to do next year, and it's a great time to take a few minutes to apply to speak. And of course, we have another opportunity because the fall is always a very busy time in healthcare conference time. And so we have the next opportunity is the AHIMA National Conference, which is October 4th through 6th, 2026. And that is being held in San Antonio, Texas. So are you trying something new in health information? Have you improved how things get done? AHIMA invites you to saddle up and share it. You can submit your abstract for consideration, and your presentation may be part of next year's lineup. Interested in what tracks they feature? They will have six distinct areas, including policy and government, privacy and security, coding, career advancement, documentation and data integrity, and finally, operational outcomes. So, as with the ACTIS conference and RIS, they do have a wonderful committee who reviews all proposals. And so anybody who is selected does also get free registration to the AHIMA conference. So if you're interested in speaking at AHIMA, then please do check out the link in the show notes. Everything is always included on the show notes that is on the page for that particular podcast episode. So if you're ever looking for anything, that is how you find it. We have sadly run out of time. So as a reminder, don't forget to claim your 0.5 ACTIS CEUs. You have to listen to the full recording of this podcast. So click on today's episode from the list on the page, scroll down to the recording and click play, and wait until the entire episode has completed, like the timer has to get to zero, and that is when the CEU link does appear. So you click on that, take the survey, and your certificate is automatically emailed to you. And of course, we put those instructions on the show notes page. To ensure your certificate reaches you, we do recommend you use a personal email address because often your organizations will have spam filters or various security settings that do not allow us to send an email that includes your certificate. So using those personal email addresses can make sure that you get that certificate. And the cutoff for the CEUs is Sunday, December 21st at 11 p.m. Eastern. But never fear, we always have a brand new episode coming up in 2 weeks. And that is true, even though the next episode is going to be released on December 31st, so New Year's Eve. But it may be New Year's Eve, but we're still focusing on the important topics in CDI. So that episode will feature an update on the new SOFA criteria. So very, very interesting. Definitely don't want to miss that. And of course, you do not have to listen live when it's first released. The podcasts remain active on our website, so you can always come back to interesting topics and listen to them. To make sure you never miss an episode, please do make sure you have subscribed to our free weekly newsletter, CDI Strategies. And as a reminder, you can listen to the podcast anytime on the ACTIS website or via whatever your favorite podcast platform may be. And please, if you're listening via a podcast platform, do leave us a 5-star review. It does help others find our program. Our intro and outro music is called Media Noche by D. Yankee, and our ad music is Take Me Higher by Jazzar, both obtained from the Free Music Archive. If you have suggestions for future guests or topics, please email us at info@actis.org. And with that, I want to wish everyone a very, very happy holiday. Thank you so much for spending your time with us this year in 2025. I hope it has been a good one for you. And until next time, take care.